right, so please let's open it up for conversations, thoughts, comments, ideas, proposals for peace. Yeah.
Is there any effect of the large Russian Jewish immigration on Jerusalem? Or did they mostly end up in other places and they're not that involved?
That's a good question. And I don't have an answer. I would need to research it. I mean, certainly in terms of three domains, and this, whether this is true of Jerusalem or not, I can't say, the Russians have had a profound influence. First of all of the Russian intellectuals, they have contributed significantly to the intellectual growth of Israel. That's A. B, because they had no experience with democracy, we tend to see that the Russian parties are both extremely secular and extremely right-wing nationalist in their orientation. Some of them are pragmatic nationalists and some of them are extremist nationalists, but they don't value democracy. They value strongman politics. And that is very important to understand in the shifting political landscape of Israel. They don't value democracy, and the ultra-Orthodox don't value democracy. So who values democracy? I don't know. It's going to be it's a tricky, tricky scenario if we call Israel a democratic state. The other piece is that they've introduced a very complex dynamic of who is Jewish in Israel, because you have tons of what we call Russian Jews who the Orthodox don't see as Jewish. And so how that's going to shake up the ethnic composition, what constitute Jewishness, is unclear. As you can see from all the Christmas trees now in Israel in December.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yes?
Since this wall went up, what has been the statistics for terrorism now?
Reduced. It's true. There's no argument that that terrorism has gotten itself under control. And I mean, one of the issues was that Jerusalem, because it has no real hinterland that's economically of significance, tourism and commerce were its lifeblood, and the terrorist attacks were devastating to it. It's true. So yes, there's a very complicated issue there. On the one hand, the primary responsibility of the state is to ensure the security of its citizens. On the other hand, how are we going to deal with the fact that it's created this impossible social and political dynamic as a result?
It's a controversy.
It's a controversy that for which there is not an easy answer, if any, right now. I don't know if there's an answer right now.
Do you ever see a time when they might take that fence down?
Well, we have the example of the Berlin Wall, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? So...
That came down after reunification.
Hmm. Right. We'll see. I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Yes, want to... to me, as someone that grew up in Israel, and until 67, Israel, like you said, it was a real dump.
And it was a real
Jerusalem.
Dump.
Jerusalem. But what I want to tell you guys is just 7 weeks ago, I streamed a movie in Netflix called Journey to Jerusalem, and it's documented Leonard Bernstein and Isaac Stern going to Israel 2.5 weeks after the end of the 67 war. And to me, growing up in Israel, all of that era is in black and white. And suddenly to see it in color was amazing. And to see Jerusalem in 1967, and to see all of those places was a cultural shock. It was so different than what I remember it growing up in Israel. And it was fascinating to see Jerusalem back in 1967 and in color.
What was the name of it, please?
Journey to Jerusalem.
Thank you.
Other ideas, comments, Peter?
First time I was in Jerusalem was 1965, and a cousin of my mother lived in Jerusalem, whom I visited, and he had some connection to Hebrew University, and Okay, he had just moved into a small apartment in a building, and he took me to the window, and the next house across a street was already in Jordan. And on the roof, he lived on maybe the third or fourth floor, yeah. And on the roof of that other building, there was an Arab soldier with a machine gun. Looking down, it was like one floor or maybe two floors higher than his apartment, looking right down into his bedroom. And then we had lunch. I mean, and that's
that
when...
That sounds like
that's
a Jerusalem
when,
story.
And that's where they lived, and that's how Jerusalem was. And I don't remember it as a dump. It was a place. It was a city.
Well, I'm relating how it was self-described, which is kind of interesting by the people. I wasn't...
Well, compared to New York, it was a dump.
By the way,
I would say probably compared to Vienna in the 20s, maybe it was seen as a dump. I don't know.
You gave an example of the sport world of the Jerusalem Marathon, but on the other end, I just want to tell you about another event that happened in sport in Jerusalem just last week, I think. There's a very famous soccer team in Jerusalem called Beitar Yerushalayim. Beitar Jerusalem, they're a very famous team. They have supporters, very, very devoted supporters. And
they play at Teddy Pollock Stadium.
Right. And basically, they owned by a Russian billionaire that have connection with a Chechnyan billionaire. So he wanted the Chechnyan guy to put money into the team, and the Chechnyan guy wanted two of his players to go to play for the Beitar Yerushalayim. Now the problem here is that those two players are Muslims.
Yeah.
So a lot of the fan organization decided they are against it. And they did something that is rarely seen in soccer. One of those Chechnyans player scored a goal for Beitar, and the Beitar fan stood up and left the stadium as protest, which is inconceivable, but that's Jerusalem.
There's one other well-known an important institution in Jerusalem, and that's Bezalel.
Yes.
It was founded first.
Earlier.
Yeah. It's a college of design and art, and does magnificent work. And I think that goes back also
to,
yeah.
I think it may even go back to the, I think early 30s, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
So that would be like RISD here.
Right.
Or, you know, something like that.
The USSR issue, Cold
yes.
War issue. I know, or it seems to me, that when the USSR ceased to exist, the whole scale of balance throughout the world got messed up, shifted. And it also seems to me that with the USSR backing certain Arab countries, we almost needed to go in and back Israel and provide a lot of arms because that was an outpost
proxy
for
wars.
Us.
Proxy wars, right.
And now with the USSR gone, although Russia is trying to come back, and with the Arab Spring, our reason for backing Israel seems to have disappeared to a degree. And I wonder how, I'd like you to talk about that, because I think, you know, how it might play out in, you know, Ohio or someplace like that, where back in the day, you know, in 1980 or whatever, sure, you know, we have to stand up against those Reds. Now they might say, well, gee, why are we spending our money? Who are we standing up against or for?
I think that Thomas Friedman just wrote that in his article, that
one of the reasons why the United States may not put on the front burner Israel at this point is simply because we don't have to deal with the threat of the Soviet Union. And so there, that may cause a break and a, you know, and the lack of peace process, progress in the peace accords, you know, there's a peace fatigue and there's no pressure. Yes, yeah, that's a, that is certainly, I think what I hear you saying partially is America became the stalwart backer of Israel in a particular era. I mean, originally, you know, I mean, Truman wanted to vote against the establishment of the State of Israel. There's some of you who may know, there's the famous story that his the co-owner of his store back in, his business partner was Jewish. And in the debates about approving the partition and then accepting and then agreeing to the establishment of the State of Israel, the State Department was very anti-Semitic. And Truman was not in favor of it. And so I think it was Weizmann who asked, I forget his name now, to go and speak to him at the White House and to give and to try to persuade him. And that was one of the reasons, supposedly, that's given. The other reason was that Truman was afraid that if they said no, that a lot of the refugees from Europe, like 100,000, would be clamoring to come to the United States. And he didn't want that. So, you know, the Soviet Union did. It supported the establishment of the State of Israel. It was one of those weird things at the UN that happened. It was politically motivated. But then, subsequently, and you have to realize, of course, that the, and this doesn't relate to Jerusalem, actually, but that the Israeli secular, you know, the secular Israelis, on really for many times, they were Soviet, they were communist. They were very pro-Soviet Union until all the bad stuff started really seeping out. And so the early pioneers had also very interesting mixed emotions. For example, many of them saw America as corrupt and a corrupting influence on Israeli society. Now that I, which probably was true, but that's another issue. Debbie?
It bothers me a little bit to hear about the common description of Jewish quarter, Arab quarters of Jerusalem being close to a dump or looking unusual, because it's the same description that we've seen all along for Jews from the Arab world. And no matter how it looks, there was there a vibrant community, whether they were Jews or Arabs, and the description is viewed through the eyes of somebody that's been living in a Western country, like Vienna for Teddy Kollek. It reminds me, I went to a talk by Yael Dayan. That is true from the left or the right. Yael Dayan, which I was shocked to listen, that what do the Israelis have to do with Sheikh Jarrah? Sheikh Jarrah is a dump. We should give it back. That's not the way we're going to do peace, especially that I think Jerusalem is the key to the peace in the area. As far as I'm concerned, if we keep on having that attitude that our culture, Western culture, is the best, I think we're in the wrong country, we're in the wrong region.
Thank you. And David, I want to apologize. You're absolutely correct. Okay? First of all, I didn't, and I'm not trying to defend myself, because I actually agree with you. And one of my strong ambivalences about the Zionist attitude, you know, people will say, we have a right to the land because we turned it into a flourishing, whatever, garden or whatever it is, right? Does come out of this Western notion of progress and Western ideas. And we have to be cautious, really cautious, about imposing those. And I think that I got trapped. I will agree with you that I got trapped in that in preparing this talk, because I I didn't know Jerusalem until much later. The descriptions in this book by Segev, which I use, and we would argue that Segev is a real liberal leftist, were emphatically emphasized both the decrepit and impoverished neighborhoods, he calls it Musara, of Jerusalem that were inhabited primarily by immigrants from North Africa and other parts of the Middle East. And you're correct that it's a very problematic attitude to continue to have this superiority of Western civilization and ignoring the richness of local homegrown culture, even if it wasn't, you know, glossy on the Western model. I think you're right. And myself, I'm not trying to establish any credentials. When I was living in France, the main focus of my studies was on the Jews of Arab lands. And I learned a tremendous amount that really stopped me from, it created a break in that attitude that the West, the Jews from the West, are superior. What is troubling, and I don't know enough about this, is it true that also Jews that came from Arab countries tend to have a more hostile attitude towards Arabs? Is that true, or is that also a misconception?
I think it's a total misconception.
Oh, there you go. So, and I'm glad I'm putting you on the
spot. My father's generation suffered, but in very light terms, nothing like a pogrom or a ghetto or anything of the type. My generation went only the other way almost. Whatever my father suffered, I don't want anybody on earth to suffer, to go through. So that's why I think that from a position of strength that we are in Israel right now, after 48, 67, 73, this is the time to recognize our weaknesses and actually say, no, we Jews don't want to do anything, don't want to have anything to do with second-class citizens, with whatever the crazy situation the Arabs have in Jerusalem, and so on and so on. We should be a little bit more innovative and actually create something new.
So I want to tell a story also about this question. I think you're raising something very important about the hubris that that we have to take. We, and here I speak more generally of the Jewish people, aligning ourselves with certain notions of Western superiority that we have to be careful of, and that maybe Israel has to be careful of also in its relations with its neighbors. But I want to give an internal Jewish story that was two mini ones that elucidate this complexity. So when the Zionists wanted to encourage the immigration of Jews from Arab lands to Israel, right? Once the state was created, the idea was that every Jew should go to Israel, and they sent shlichim to countries where there might have been some, you know, Zionist ferment, but not on the scale that you had in places like Eastern Europe for some of the reasons that you talk about, right? So those Jews, there are stories that the Jews of Arab lands, who were still very tied to their traditional, you know, beliefs, when they agreed to make Aliyah, but when they left, they wanted to take the artifacts of their home. They wanted to take their candlesticks and their chamsas and all of these other things. This is what they know. This is their home. They were told often by the shlichim, leave it all behind. When you get to Israel, you're going to become new Jews and you don't need it anymore. And there are anthropologists who say that this was very damaging to those Jewish communities because it created a sense of deracination. So you have these Jews going to the Jewish homeland but feeling very disconnected from the Jewish state because they were denied having their cultural connections and their cultural roots. And that one of the reasons, of course, why Begin was seen as a kind of popular was that he appealed to some of those, you know, we, these Ashkenazi superiority folks, you know, it was a bit of a backlash. And the other story that is really distressing, but it's a personal one that I heard, and that I think elucidates also the complexities of this state, is I met when I was in Geneva a Moroccan Israeli Jewish woman whose family eventually all settled in Israel. But the reason they settled in Israel was quite a bizarre story. The family had French passports when they were living in Morocco. And she had older brothers who were teenagers when she was a baby. And they had no intention, her parents, of going to Israel, of making Aliyah. This was in the 50s. But her older brother had joined a Zionist youth group. And they told the brother that they were taking a field trip to Israel. Great, very exciting, right? So he had his passport, his French passport, etc. He went with his youth group. They confiscated his passport and didn't give it back to him. And basically kept him there. And he couldn't go home. And as a result of the fact that he couldn't go home, eventually the family went. They went to Israel because they wanted to be reunited with their son. The family did not know what happened to the passport until much, much later when certain archives were opened up. And I'll tell you why this is sort of important. They discovered, yes, indeed, they had basically stolen their son's passport and confiscated it. They were able to get it back. And why was it important? Because this woman, they want to get French citizenship because this woman's sons are very, very important. They're pianists, very talented classical pianists, and they want to get citizenship in the EU to make it easier for their career. So that was a story that shows how complicated the dynamics were of the establishment of the state, and that they are complicated not only in relation to the Arabs, but internally in relation to our fellow Jews. Okay, should we take one more, or then should we end?
I just wanted to say, does this mean that next year's series is going to be devoted to
the Jews of Arabans? That was what I wanted to do this year. It's a really big topic. I would love to do it. And maybe let me just close with a very hopeful story, a story that I love. And this gets back to a story that I've kept in my heart forever. So when I was in France, I was taking a class on the history of the Jews of Tunisia in the modern era with a Tunisian Jew who now is a professor in, maybe he was a visiting professor. I don't remember. But anyway, he was a Tunisian Jewish professor. And so he told the story that the Jews of North Africa had very different relationships with their Muslim neighbors than did the Jews of Europe. And this was historically for hundreds and hundreds of years. And he gave an example. He said, at Passover, the last day of Passover, there was a custom in Tunis, it would be inconceivable for any of you who come from Poland or Russia to imagine this. There was a custom that the Muslim neighbors would bake the bread in their ovens for the Jews to break Passover with. And that was a common custom. And it was partly attributed to the fact that the rules around kashrut were less paranoid, shall we say, because the Muslims didn't eat pork. But also because the nature of intercommunal relationships, despite ups and downs, was such that it was considered normal for the Muslims to bring to the Jewish homes and for the Jews to come to the homes of their Muslim neighbors to break Pesach. So maybe we can hope one day, maybe that will be the case in the land of Israel. That's it. Okay.
Thank you.